Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing very well, Justin.
Real quick, going to be in Los Angeles November 5th, and I'm going to go to the Brew Yard in Glendale. I'll probably be there at 4 p.m., and I'll probably stay there until around 8 p.m. So if you want to come hang out for a few hours with me, the Brew Yard in Glendale on a Saturday, November 5th. What else we got?
We have premium episodes up both on our website and on iTunes. Now, to get to our premium episodes in iTunes, you have to first go to the iTunes Music Store, then look for Generation Y Podcast. Justin and I are about to release our latest premium episode. You won't want to miss this one.
No.
And we've had a great number of listeners write in lately, sending the kindest words I've ever heard. Thank you all very much. Some of the recent ones were Logan and Dara. So thank you very much. Halloween's coming up.
Yeah, this is our Halloween-y episode. Tonight's episode was a hugely requested one, wasn't it?
We wanted to cover something for Halloween. And, well, there aren't too many cases creepier than Ed Gein.
And I know that some people probably have Ed Gein fatigue. You think you've heard all about him on YouTube and other podcasts. Trust me, this is going to be different. So where do we start with this wonderful character of American history?
Ed Gein is a name that many people know. A good number of them probably don't know that well. But Ed Gein was a man who was arrested in 1957.
On my birthday.
He was arrested after the apparent abduction and murder of Bernice Worden, who operated a shop in Plainfield, Wisconsin.
When authorities arrested him, they went into his house and found some horrible atrocities, such as furniture with human skin, skulls, all kinds of body parts, and Bernice hanging as if she was an animal or slab of meat from a meat hook and she'd been gutted. It's caused a lot of folklore and movies and other things because of this one guy.
The story of Edward Theodore Gein probably begins many years before his birth. And it starts with his parents. His father was George Gein. George had a very rough childhood, to put it mildly. When he was just 3 years old, his father, mother, and sister headed off and were caught in a flash flood and were wiped away.
This is Oregon Trail style, like just gone.
And this is in Coon Valley, Wisconsin. As he grew up, he became an alcoholic and worked many different jobs, just couldn't stay in one place. Edward Gein's mother is Augusta. Her father was a very strict disciplinarian, and he was very religious. He was Lutheran. He was of a spare the rod, spoil the child mentality.
Spare the rod, don't use it, spoil the child.
Yeah, they're basically saying if you don't get tough with your kids, they'll be screw-ups. Mm-hmm.
He was a very fire and brimstone kind of guy. So Augusta is raised in a household that believes that revelation is going to happen. They're probably hoping for it to happen. Earthly delights and pleasures are not to be consumed.
Now, when they meet, George is 24 and Augusta is 19. We have no idea what brought these two together. And even having read many stories about this, no one really has any good information as far as I can tell. Use your imagination. It could be as simple as they were both Lutheran. Yeah. It could be that simple. They met, he was Lutheran, maybe at the time he was working, and they get married on December 4th, 1899. The relationship was troubled early on, but given her religious beliefs, this wasn't a marriage that was going to end in divorce.
Marriages were on the up and up from 1900 to 1955. Divorce rates were steadily going up, but they weren't at the same rate as marriages. So it wouldn't be until about 1950s that divorce rates were keeping up. And that's probably because it's very taboo for you to be a single mother. It's very taboo for people to divorce, especially if they're part of the church and all those things. But regardless, that's a sin and you're not going to get a divorce. So they're going to stay together till death do us part.
And checking the directories from the time, it very much seems like Lutherans and Methodists were the majority.
Yeah, but they were on another level, to the point where they didn't even like the other Lutherans or Methodists or anybody.
It's well known that Augusta frowned upon sex, yet she had a child in 1902. On January 17th of that year, their son Henry was born. And I believe that she had the child because she thought it would help things.
Yeah. I mean, that's what you do when you have a farm and, you know, all these things, is the kid works.
As we said, George is an alcoholic, and as time goes on, he's becoming less and less reliable, and he's spending more and more of his funds on alcohol.
Now, it's said that they're very abusive to each other physically and verbally.
Yeah, I believe she's verbally abusive and he's physically abusive. They say he doesn't really say a lot. So he either just goes and gets drunk, or he goes and gets drunk and then hits her. One of the things that she would do was, if she was getting slapped down, she would start praying for his demise.
Well, yeah. What else would you pray for?
In other words, she couldn't just go get a divorce, but maybe God could take care of him for her. All I can say is that her opinion of men is not very high. And so she decides to have another child with her husband, which, of course, she really doesn't want to have sex with him, but this is the only way she's going to have a child.
It's all about procreation.
That's right. So she has this second child, and she prays for a daughter. But on August 27th of 1906, they have another son, and they name him Edward. She is very disappointed, but she decides to make the best of it. And she vows that this one will not be like the others, meaning this boy will not be like the other men. In 1909, something big happens, which is George becomes the proprietor of a grocery store.
Go George.
Yeah. So maybe George is finally doing the right thing. He's working and earning money for the family.
I think he just wanted the wholesale price on alcohol, but that's just speculation.
Yeah, and there might be some truth in that because, yes, he starts drinking inventory. In 1911, in the directory, Augusta is listed as the owner of the grocery store.
So, change of ownership, same management.
Actually, that, you know, that's where she was probably running that store early on. She wasn't going to let his laziness and alcoholism get in the way of success. After all, she didn't have time for pleasures, so you might as well throw yourself into your work. Henry and Ed, there were some differences between them, but they were both living under the same mother, and that's where she didn't want them to have friends. She didn't want them to be interested in girls because, well, every woman, aside from herself, was probably a whore or an instrument of the devil.
That's the only way you could put it, because that's her words. That's not our words. Those are her words. And she was very much into Revelation and the whore of Babylon and a lot of different ideals about the end times that refer to whoredom and sinful behaviors. Now, you would have to kind of have somebody really interpret that to get her interpretation, because if you read the Revelation yourself, you probably just think, well, no, there's evil, there's good, there's people that are prostitutes, there's others. But her interpretation is very straight lined, and I don't know how somebody can distort it that badly.
Well, she also read a lot of the Old Testament. And we could read you the passages she would read to her children, but I think you have the idea of what kind of passages she was choosing to read to them.
It was all the fire and brimstone, end times, horrible, or the best parts of the Bible, really. I mean, it's the parts of the Bible that they make movies about, because they don't make movies about the boring parts.
Well, as well as the sinfulness of people.
Yeah.
Ed grew up in this environment where he felt like he had to please his mother, only she was impossible to please. That didn't stop him, though. There are stories of incidents that happened. One was when he was given some money to go to town to buy some provisions, and he ended up losing the money on the way there. And he waited quite a while before he came back to basically bow before his mother and admit that he had failed. And her response was, only a mother could love you. So once again, his only source of, and we're talking about a tiny sliver, his only source of happiness or pleasure came from his mother. And she meted it out in such small doses that he lived for just a tiny drop.
That's sort of where Psycho comes into play. That's what the inspiration is.
As he grew up, she made Henry and Ed swear to stay virgins. She didn't want them to have friends, really. She didn't want them getting involved in relationships.
And anything that was related sexually was just oppressed to the point where they probably didn't have a clue what puberty or dating or any of those things were. So
now, when he was pretty young, his parents were nowhere around one day, and he went wandering off behind the building, behind their store. He discovered his parents slaughtering a hog.
Wasn't he not, like, wasn't that off limits to him? Like, he wasn't supposed to go back there?
That's right. Well, and he didn't know where his parents were, and I think he was perhaps curious about the building. He goes around back. His father is holding the hog still. It's being held upside down from the ceiling, and his mother is cutting it open.
Gutting it.
In 1913, Augusta moved the family, including her husband, who obviously didn't have much to say in the matter, to a small dairy farm. And this is because she had saved up enough money from the grocery store that she could make this move. She wanted to get to a farm.
Now, what was her motivation for the farm? She kind of wanted to get away from the people in the other town because she felt they were all tainted with the devil.
Right. Even fellow devout Christians weren't good enough for her. It seemed no one was good enough for her. But in 1914, she moves again to another farm. And this one is further away. This one is in Plainfield, Wisconsin.
Outside of it. It's kind of out in the sticks.
Yeah, but this, it's closest to. So they had come from La Crosse, Wisconsin, and went to Plainfield, Wisconsin. It's about 40 miles away. First farm they went to was on the small side, but this second farm that they moved to in 1914, it had 195 acres. There was a two-story house, there was a barn, a chicken coop, and a shed. Augusta is listed as the person purchasing the farm.
I'm on like a quarter or half acre, my lot, so that's a lot of land.
It's a lot of land, and because she's listed as the owner, once again, she's the one running everything. It's not unheard of at the time. It's just, it's more common for the husband to have his name on everything. But back in these times, there were women that purchased property, purchased businesses, started businesses. The two-story home was kept very, very tidy by Augusta. One of the things that she liked about this home was the nearest neighbors were about a quarter mile away. Now, to keep them from establishing relationships or having friends, she kept them busy. They worked the farm. They went to town for provisions only, and she was able to keep a good eye on them. The father would drink, and he would beat his family. He would hit his children, but that would go away once his kids started to get a bit bigger.
Then he just became the absentee, neglectful father. Yeah.
Right. He didn't. Once they got to a certain size, he knew he couldn't just hit them. And especially with Henry, I think, because Henry was someone who didn't really care for the way things were running at the house, whereas Ed was accepting of it. This is just the way it is. Henry would start to get more vocal with his father, so George was probably feeling rather low because he had his wife berating him, and he had his eldest son standing up to him. He was already quiet and a drunk. He just basically wanted to disappear, I think. In 1940, George Gein would pass away, and he had spent the years from 1937 to 1940 as an invalid, so his sons had to take care of him. The farm itself, though, it just never really made any money. They made enough to get by, to scrape by. So Henry and Ed would take various jobs to help make ends meet. Ed would also watch kids, so he was a babysitter. And he would play with them or read to them, which was something that he enjoyed doing. In fact, he was actually an okay student when he was in school, but reading was his best skill.
He dropped out of school in eighth grade, though, right?
Eighth grade was the last grade that he attended. I believe he and Henry, didn't they both end school about the same time?
Yeah, and they started working for other farmers, helping out, work the land, doing jobs in town for people. Of course, this is all to, I mean, make money, but Augusta's not happy that they're interacting and having to form relationships with people. So a little bit of a conflict there.
In 1944, a runaway fire in the marshland near their home caused Henry and Ed to take action.
I thought they actually said it.
Well, here's the thing. At the time, the newspapers were reporting that Ed had set the fire to clear some marshland, but it does get away from them, so they're trying to contain it. According to Ed, he loses sight of his brother Henry.
He returns to the house, and Henry never returns.
Some people go looking for Henry. They don't find him. Ed would lead a search party right to him.
But it's like he went out with the neighbors first to go look for him. They couldn't find him. And then when they got the authorities involved and stuff, that's when he led them right to his brother. Kind of sort of covering that up, covering his tracks of, well, we went out and looked in this area earlier, and now we're going out and looking again. Oh, here he is. Not quite as convenient or suspicious as it's always been made out to be, but the fact that he let him write to him the second try still leads me to think that there was something up with that.
Yeah, he's asked, why is it that you could find him so quickly this time? He just replies, funny how that works. Now, it's been reported that there was bruising on Henry's head, but if you actually look at what the police response is, they say they check everything out and there's nothing suspicious about the death. And the official cause of death is listed as asphyxiation.
Which is kind of hard to buy because they're outdoors. His brother wasn't burned up. And you know, and they're adults at this point. A full-size adult can't find his way out of smoke. And I just have a problem with that. I know it's possible, but I really have a problem with somebody dying outside from smoke inhalation.
As I said, the police did not suspect foul play, although many people remarked that they just didn't see Ed as someone who could harm anybody, especially not his own brother. But one interesting thing that was going on around that time was Henry, because he was older now, he's in his early 40s, he was definitely standing up to his father the last so many years before his father's death, and was really trying to make his own way. In other words, his mother was not a great influence on him anymore. He was much more independent, and he had begun to talk to his brother Ed about finding his own path, not just listening to his mother, but really establishing his own identity. And as far as we can tell, Ed didn't really care for Henry's words of wisdom.
Well, it was after their father died, he was trying to get Ed to move out, go live his life. Yeah, people stayed nuclear families all at home for a lot longer back then, but it was probably his tone of, you need to stop listening to your mother. You're a grown man, so let's get on with it. She's not a good influence on you. But you got to take into account that this is somebody that has been indoctrinated their entire life. So he's not going to hear what his brother wants to say.
Augusta is a tough woman, but the death of her son Henry seems to really hit home with her. She suffers a stroke. Now, while she's hospitalized, Ed stays right by her side. He reads her the Bible. Days later, he would take her home and care for her around the clock. Even though Augusta would seem to recover and eventually she would start walking again, in December of 1945, she would suffer a second stroke. It's attributed to she and Ed go to get some straw from a neighbor named Smith. When they approach Smith's property, Smith is outside beating a dog to death. While they're approaching, a woman comes out of Smith's place and starts yelling at him to stop. Augusta tells Ed that this woman is not married to him, that, you know, basically they're living in sin. This man finishes beating the dog to death, and Augusta is just really upset that this man has a living girlfriend. She will end up suffering a second stroke. She will pass away on December 29th. Official cause of death, cerebral brain hemorrhage. And unlike his father's death or his brother's death, the loss of his mother is a serious blow to Ed, and he just sobs, and everybody sees the grief on his face.
They say, though, he's at least at the funeral, he is wailing like a child. You lose a parent, and that's terrible. But he's not a man. He's not taking it like a man. He's taking it like a child. I kind of think he stopped maturing at a very young age. Like, he was mentally there, and he was not stupid by any stretch of the imagination. He was very well read. He could read the Bible very clearly, at least. But his maturity level, I think he was stunted by his mother. So he's very childlike in many ways.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
His mother is dead. He's alone at the farm. People notice that the farm begins to show signs of neglect. Ed began to stink because he stopped bathing regularly. People who had already not given him much respect began to play pranks on him. One of the things that they did was they threw a smoke bomb in his truck. Other times they would pour brandy into his beer so his face would get screwed up when he started drinking it.
And he kind of had a droopy eye, so these things would exaggerate those. You know, if he's drunk or, you know, whatever, they could pick on him for that.
Yeah, when he was a kid, a group of kids started calling him Saggy Baggy Eye. And back then, he would just cry and cry and cry. As Justin said, he had trouble maturing, and it was because, obviously, his mother had stunted that, would not allow him to mature and grow as a man. Ed continued to do odd jobs, and he leased parts of his land for pay. He wasn't socializing, really, but he was reading a lot. And he was reading from a medical textbook on anatomy. He was reading true crime magazines that were pretty sensational. He was also reading about cannibalism in the South Seas, exhumations of bodies, as well as atrocities during World War II.
Because that had just ended.
And all of the information about World War II was coming out, surprising information about what Nazi Germany had been up to.
I mean, the Holocaust was front page news.
So we already said that his house was being neglected. Very few people got to see the inside of his house, but he had boarded up some of the rooms in the house to keep them preserved, just the way his mother had left them. But the rest of the house, they say that it looked like he kept bringing in just garbage or junk and just leaving it around the rooms.
He was a hoarder.
It was like a hoarder house. It didn't look like it was very deep, but it was just a complete mess on the inside, which I think reflected his state of mind. This is not a healthy person. He's lost his entire family in a very short span of time, and now he's on his own. And as we said, he's not very mature in a lot of ways, so he's coping the best way that he knows how, I suppose. Some strange series of events starts to occur after the death of his mother. On December 8th of 1954, there's a tavern owned and run by Mary Hogan. It was a place that Ed would frequently go if he wasn't at home or working. Ed would drink a few beers. Mary was middle-aged and had a pronounced German accent. Now, Ed would look at her and think she kind of reminded him of his mother. This is kind of a larger woman. I mean, she was 200 pounds. She and his mother were a little different in that his mother was very careful about the way she spoke. Now, we could say she had a very negative view of the world, but to Ed, that was normal. What was not normal to him was the way that Mary spoke, because she cursed a lot.
You probably liked that.
She was a tavern owner. I'm sure that's probably no big deal for most people. A farmer named Seymour Lester on December 8th would walk into Mary's tavern and discovered a pool of blood. The sheriff would be called. A .32 caliber cartridge was found, as well as evidence that a body was dragged out into the parking lot from the tavern. This is a strange occurrence in this town, and obviously she was taken against her will, probably murdered right there in the store. A man named Elmo was talking with Ed one day, and he's a guy that would hire him to do jobs once in a while. He said, you know, if you spent more time courting Mary, she'd be cooking for you instead of being missing. And Ed's response was, she's not missing. She's down at the house now.
What?
Not only that, but other people overheard Ed say directly that either, yes, she's down at the house now, or, yeah, I drove my truck over to her tavern and picked her up and took her home. But see, Ed is an oddball. Yeah, people look at him and they see this weird guy. He's got the droopy eyelid that's due to a growth in the corner of his eye. And his speech is a little off. And his mannerisms and everything seem kind of effeminate. People either see him as a good worker, or they see him as someone who needs to be pitied, or they see him as someone to tease and to make fun of. And that's his whole life. That's how the public views him. And he's a good worker, but he's odd. He would just suddenly laugh out loud sometimes, and no one would know why. So you could see why people, if they hear him saying these things, they would think he's having us on. He's just joking around.
He's just seriously awkward, socially inept.
They don't think much of it. Ed's neighbors, Donald and Georgia Foster, were visited by him one day, and he proposed a trade. He said, hey, take my farm, I'll take your house, we'll just do an even trade. They were kind of intrigued because Ed had a lot of property. Now, as we know, property is money. They decided to go to his place to check it out. They hadn't really been there. So they're going around in the place, and they can see how squalid the house is. It's so disgusting in there. Just as Justin said, it's a hoarder house.
But he doesn't really let him inside. I mean, he lets him in like the front parlor area, and that's about it.
Yeah, he lets them walk around, but it seems like a good number of the doors are secured shut.
This is a two-story house. I mean, this is a large house, and they're only able to see 10% of it. Kind of odd.
You can see where they're probably thinking, I don't know if we want to trade. We don't know what comes over her, because she couldn't explain it either, but at some point, Georgia asks Ed about a rumor that she's heard. And this is what she says. She points at a door and she asked if he had the shrunken heads in there. And it's something that a number of people have been talking about around town, that Ed was in possession of these shrunken heads that had been given to him from overseas. And his response was, no, they're in this other room over here. And once again, she thinks, oh, he's joking. No one takes Ed seriously.
There's also, she didn't ask him about this, but there's another rumor that there's a ghost of a woman who dances at night in the front yard. That is a little odd, because there's no ghost and there's no females that live at the house any longer. So who's this woman who's dancing unclothed in the moonlight?
Several years later, on November 16th, 1957, there's a woman named Bernice Warden, and she runs a shop. Her father had owned the store along with a man who would become her husband. Her husband would buy out the store from her father and take full ownership of it, but he only lived a couple more years, and in 1931, she would take full possession of the shop. She even ended up buying the building that her store was in.
It's more like a general store. They have hardware and food and supplies. It's not specific. It's more of a general store.
She was able to grow the store under her ownership. Everyone around town respected her as a very capable business person. Her son, Frank, would work most days in the shop with her. On November 15th of 1957, Ed Gein would visit the store and he would speak with Frank about antifreeze. And he would tell him, I'll be in the next day to get the antifreeze. He asked him, hey, tomorrow hunting season opens. Are you going hunting? And Frank, thinking nothing of it, just says, yeah, I'm going to be out there first thing in the morning. On November 16th, 1957, Frank is off hunting. And this is when something bad happens to Bernice. Frank returns from hunting and he's told about how the store's truck left. The store is now locked. It's closed. Yet the lights are still burning.
And it's really odd for it to be closed on the first day of hunting because people are going to go there for stuff. This would probably be a very busy day for them.
Now, Frank can't just go in the store. He needs to go home and get the key for the store. So he does that. And the first thing he notices is that the cash register is missing. And then he sees there are bloodstains that lead out the back door. His first thought is that Ed Gein did this.
He finds the receipt on the counter.
Well, right. But Frank has had different positions in the town, important positions. One of them is he was law enforcement in that town for a while. And he calls the sheriff. The sheriff and his chief deputy get there. And he tells them, Ed did this. He had to have done this. He shows them a receipt that he found.
And that's for the antifreeze that Ed had purchased. And it was the only receipt that day written out.
Now, I don't think it has Ed's name on it, but it is for antifreeze. And Ed had been hanging around the store a lot and had been asking Bernice out a lot. He had been asking her out to go to the movies. He had been asking her to go to the roller skating rink. And of course, she didn't want to go anywhere with him because she was definitely not interested in Ed Gein. So because they know something terrible happened to Bernice, they basically call in law enforcement, investigators, and officers from around the area, from nearby towns, etc. And by about 7 p.m. in the evening, all of these law enforcement people show up in Plainfield, Wisconsin. Because Frank is so adamant that Ed must have done this, they focus on getting a hold of Ed so they can talk to him. They want to find out if he was involved, see if there's any evidence. And they start going around where they expect him to be. And one of the places is his house, but he's not there. Then they send a couple of officers to the Hills residence.
Bob, the son of Lester and Irene, had asked him for a ride to get into town. And he came into Ed's yard and said, hey, I need a ride. And Ed came running out. His arms were all bloody. And Ed says, sorry, I'm dressing a deer. Let me wash up. So he goes back in the house. He washes up. Then he comes back out and he takes Bob into town. And then he goes over to the Hills to have dinner.
Now, Bob doesn't know it, but Ed doesn't hunt deer. In fact, he's not a hunter. The news of Bernice Warden's abduction has reached even their place. And their son, Bob, who's a teenager, says, hey, Ed, will you drive me over there so I can see what's going on? He says, okay, sure. When the officers reach the home, they talk to Mrs. Hill and they ask, have you seen Ed today? And she says, sure. He's in his car in the driveway. He's getting ready to take Bob over to see what's going on with Bernice Warden. They end up knocking on the window of the car and they ask him to step out. They say, Ed, we're going to need you to get into our squad car so we can talk with you. And he does. He gives them no trouble. They ask him, Ed, what have you done today? Tell us about what the day's been like for you. What have you been up to? He takes them through the day's events, everything he's been up to leading up to the moment that they found him. And then they say, Ed, tell us what your day's been like. Tell us again. So he starts to tell them again. Only this time his story is not the same story he told the first time, which of course gets them suspicious. Then, now that he realizes that they're suspicious of him, he says that he's been framed. And they say, for what? And he says, Mrs. Warden, she's dead, ain't she? How do you know, Ed? I heard it. At this point, they take Ed Gein into custody and they make a call to the sheriff. This is when they move on his house because they're fairly certain Ed was involved here.
I mean, he has information about a murder that he shouldn't have.
Yeah, at this point, no one knows that she's dead. And I mean,
there's people that know, but it hasn't got to the Hills residence.
They kick in Ed Gein's shed door to search for Bernice Warden. They think maybe she's being held captive if they're lucky. If not, she's probably dead in there somewhere. They pull out flashlights and they're looking around. One of them bumps into something and they turn and illuminate a headless body hanging from the ceiling.
Again, like an animal being prepped or...
Yeah, they say it's like a dressed out deer. Mm-hmm. It's where they split it open and they can let everything fall out of it.
It's just like how you would do a deer, pig, whatever.
They describe it as cut from crotch to sternum, and she was decapitated. But they know it's Bernice Warden. She had a wooden crossbar that was sharpened on both ends, run through both ankles, and ropes held her arms tight to her body with the fingers pointing towards her feet. After the shed, the authorities move into the house to search there. Right away, the house is just a complete wreck. There are very creepy items found all over the house, including bowls made of skulls on a kitchen table. There are skull caps on bedposts. They find four noses. They find bones. They find a string of nipples, which may be a nipple belt. They find a lampshade made of human skin. They find face masks where people's faces had been removed and made into masks. There were four chairs that were now covered in human flesh. There were flesh bracelets. There was a shade pole that was adorned with women's lips. There were gloves made from human hands. They also found 10 female heads, as well as Mary Hogan's head in a paper bag and Bernice Warden's head in a burlap sack.
So you can kind of see where Silence of the Lambs and Texas Chainsaw Massacre got their inspiration.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called StoryWorth. StoryWorth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, StoryWorth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/GenY. That's storyworth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase. when Ed is taken in, he doesn't say anything for the first 30 hours. He doesn't want to talk to anyone. They will bring in the evidence that Bernice Worden was found in his shed. And that's when Ed decides he will speak. And his first words are used to ask for an apple pie with a slice of cheddar cheese on it.
It's so weird, but it is probably a Wisconsin thing.
He eats it, and then he starts talking. He admits to murdering two people, Bernice Worden and Mary Hogan. He admits to stealing corpses from several local cemeteries. He said that between 1947 and 1952, he had made up to 40 visits to these cemeteries to dig up recently buried bodies. And he claimed that when he did this, he was in a daze-like state, and that on around 30 of the visits, he had become clear about what he was doing and then left everything alone or put things back the way they were. He admitted to exhuming 9 corpses from the ground. Only 2 were actually investigated by the authorities. So they chose 2 of the 9 he admitted to, dug up those plots, discovered empty graves. So it backs up what Ed was saying. In my opinion, they probably should have dug up all 9 of them and maybe more.
Yeah. Just going to go with a few to check his word. And they're just going to assume, okay, he's probably telling us the truth on all of them. But
let's do the math. He admits to murdering 2 people, so that's 2 heads right there. But there are 12 skulls or heads found in his house.
Along with tons of other body parts.
Right, but I'm just dealing with heads here because that's a good count. So he has at least 12 bodies in the house, and he's admitting to digging up 9. And then we have the 2 heads that belong to the 2 murder victims.
So that's 11.
That's 11. That's not 12.
There's a problem.
So either Ed doesn't remember or he's not telling the truth. And I'm not saying he's not telling the truth by taking credit for too many. I'm saying he's not taking credit for enough. There's at least one off here. Now, the Washara County Sheriff in the area is Art Schley. And hearing all this stuff just eats him up. He can't take it. So he physically assaults Ed during the questioning. Ed's initial confession is then ruled inadmissible because of this.
Don't punch the suspect.
Don't ram his head into brick. Ed's going to give it up, at least what he's already said. He's going to admit to this stuff. And in 1957, on November 21st, Ed Gein is arraigned on 1 count of first-degree murder, but he pleads not guilty by reason of insanity. And I'm sure a lot of people can understand why he would claim to be insane. Now, it's ruled that he was unfit to stand trial, so they send him to the Central State Hospital for the criminally insane. In 1958, Gein's house and property is scheduled to be auctioned off on March 30th. But 3 days prior, the house is burned down. I imagine people didn't want it being turned into a museum or something. They wanted this place gone.
Salt the earth.
Gein's car was sold at auction, and a carnival sideshow was using it to make a little money. They would charge 25 cents per person to see it. The case is already gripping the public. I mean, people are fascinated with this case, how grisly it sounds and how crazy it sounds. How could this happen? How could a guy make lampshades out of people or gloves made of people's hands?
As much as World War II was a horrible thing, this type of murder and atrocities, not the norm in America. People aren't used to serial killer, gravedigger, / furniture being made out of skin.
We know that his mother was a great influence on him, stunted him. It caused him to be very isolated. But as we said, he read a lot. And when you look over all the things that he did with these bodies, you wonder, where did that come from? Ed had read a lot about Ilse Koch, who had kept human skin artifacts during Nazi Germany's days in power. And she worked at the Buchenwald camp. She would ask for prisoners to be taken out so she could have patches of their skin that had tattoos on them. Or she would choose prisoners whose flesh she would have taken off to be tattooed later and turned into lampshades. or kept as other kinds of artifacts. And she would just point at a prisoner and then have the guards go and get that person, and then they would disappear. And then she would have some fancy artifacts. There was a Nazi camp doctor who was reading about shrunken heads, and he made some, or at least attempted to. And Ilse would keep these as decorations. So Ed was reading about this stuff and then putting it into motion. He was doing it himself.
I mean, obviously he lived on a farm, so slaughtering animals probably wasn't that alien to him. So he had the basic concepts down of how to skin an animal from the lifestyle and just living out in the country. But then to make art or furniture or clothing, I think about that woman people would see dancing in the moonlight in the front yard. And I think we now know it was Ed, if those stories are true.
He had made pants out of the flesh of some of these women. He made a vest that had breasts on it and was made of human skin and flesh. So he could put the gloves on, he could put the vest on, he could put the pants on, as well as the human flesh jewelry, and he could dance out in the moonlight outside of his house. In 1968, Gene's doctors declare him fit to stand trial. So on November 14th, 1 week trial, he's found guilty of first degree murder, but he's legally insane. So he's sent to live in a mental hospital. In 1984, Ed Gein, then 77, who was a model inmate, died of respiratory and heart failure. This was at the Mendota Mental Health Institute. He's buried, and he has a gravestone, but the gravestone was constantly under attack. There were souvenir seekers who would come and chip pieces of it off and take them home as, you know, little mementos. In the year 2000, the whole gravestone was stolen and went missing for about a year. They found it at the house of the promoter. He was making rubbings from it and selling them for $50 a piece on his website. And when the authorities got a hold of him, he said, hey, don't get too upset because this is just a replica. Now, keep in mind, this gravestone has been chipped at. It's had 666 written into it. They recover it. And they can't just put it back out in the cemetery. Back on the episode where I spoke about Eileen Wuornos with author Sue Russell, there was a topic that came up, which is nature versus nurture. When you have someone who's so evil, as some might call them, who's a serial killer, a vicious murderer, we wonder, how did they get that way? Were they born that way or were they made?
I look at Ted Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer and I think, well, that's more nature because they didn't have horrible childhoods. They weren't abused and tortured or indoctrinated. So somebody like that, like Ted Bundy, more of a nature thing. But as far as somebody like Ed Gein, I think this is the template for nurture. Now, I realize his brother came out, quote unquote, okay, but there's something to this. His father was abusive and neglectful and unloving, so that drove Ed to his mother, who had this agenda, which caused him problems. The perfect storm, combination, formula of elements and environment and influence obviously had an impact on Ed. Maybe he would have done the same thing if he had a normal life, but I truly think that there was something that changed inside of him. And when I look at the murders that he committed, I don't really think serial killer. I think a man that had complete disregard for human life. I don't know why I just don't think serial killer in this case. I think just complete disregard, and he doesn't understand the ramifications of what he's doing because he's more childlike. I could be totally off base.
I agree that Ed was probably more nurture than nature, but I always feel like no matter what the ratio is, that you always have to have something wrong with you at the start. As we saw with Henry, he turned out fine. In fact, he
started to forge his own way toward the end, but ended up dying. Now, Ed, we know now that he was insane. He had to be. It doesn't really excuse him, though. It just means that the way that he started off in life, the way that he was raised, that it had a huge influence on where he went later on. When it came to murders, I think that the largest influence on him was his mother, who I think very much devalued life around her and around him. And so it became easy to take life.
Well, and just think about not just the home life, but, you know, you were describing when they walked over to the neighbor's house and the neighbor's beating a dog to death. I mean, it's kind of country living, but it is a disregard for life. There's not a lot of sympathy or empathy going on here. More than just her, I think it's the environment. I think it's being isolated. I think it's lack of interactions, not being socialized properly. I mean, I think the guy might have died a virgin.
We talked about how Ed would dress up as a woman and dance in the moonlight. One of the other body parts that he put on himself was he would place a vulva over his crotch. So he became a full woman during this dance. They would find some vulvas at his home. Ed had told investigators that his motivation for digging up these graves was, while in a daze, that he was looking for women that reminded him of his mother in some way. So a young girl really didn't fit that. But remember, he's insane. At the time, there were other disappearances that were very strange. On May 1st of 1947, 8-year-old Georgia Reckler is dropped off after school by the lane that leads to her house. She stops to get the mail, which the person dropping her off sees her do, and she drives off, and Georgia is never seen after that. A search party is organized, and hundreds of locals search for her, and reward money is raised for information leading to her recovery. Reports had it that a black sedan was seen backing out of the driveway at the time. Now, because we know Ed was a murderer, we look back at these things and wonder, was he involved in what happened to Georgia?
I would have to go with that only on the sense that this is a small town. Are drifters coming through here in the 1940s and 50s and abducting people? I have a hard time buying that. I think when you find that there's a horrible person living in your neighborhood, you can kind of assume that disappearances and horrible things that have happened were probably him.
Ed drove a 49 Ford sedan. On October 24th, 1953, 15-year-old Evelyn Hartley was babysitting 20-month-old Janice Rasmussen at the Rasmussen's residence. It was Evelyn's habit to call home to her parents every evening and let them know what was happening, everything's okay, etc. But that evening, she didn't call home, and her father became very concerned. So he drives over to that house, and he looks through the picture room window and sees his daughter's eyeglasses and one of her loafers on the floor. A further search revealed an open basement window with footprints and bloodstains underneath it. So a search for Evelyn happens, and this search totals almost 1,000 people, and it covers about 50 miles. Evidence was found. They found a brassiere, they found panties, and they found blood-stained trousers, but her body is never recovered. The other disappearances involved two hunters and their dog.
Now, the dog ended up coming back, but they found some of the hunter's clothing.
And the reason I bring up these hunters is because some suspect that Ed may have had something to do with it. Now, obviously they're not women, but if you recall, Ed had been teased all throughout his life. And I wonder if someone may have teased him at the wrong time. Ed owned firearms.
At least a .32 Mauser and a .22 rifle.
Although I believe they suspect that Bernice Warden was shot with a rifle that was in her store.
Yeah, because he had interest in it.
But they believe that he brought his own ammunition for it. His rifle didn't fire but one type of ammunition, and they suspect that he had gone in there and said, hey, I would like one of these rifles because they fire three different types of ammunition. Two murders are attributed to Ed, as well as the exhumations of at least nine bodies. But I would say if they had investigated this with modern techniques, with modern technologies, then I think they might have found that he had killed more people than he had said he did.
Or they at least would have been able to identify each body part that he had and been able to tie it back. But this is the 1950s. DNA and all that stuff's not happening. You know, the nipple belt, the all the skulls, all these things. They would have been able to ID all that and verify who these people were. Go back to the families, have them all give DNA swabs. And then they could have said, here are all the people that are at the property. But they just were not capable of doing that. And it didn't even seem like they really tried that hard.
You wonder if they just didn't really want to know. If you think about it, the sheriff lost his cool hearing Ed talk about the crimes.
Yeah. For a man that's only accused of killing two people, in the scheme of serial killers, a very low body count that people always seem to disregard, but then he gets his notoriety from all the other things that he was accused of doing.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.